Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the 6 Points Reading Series. This is our September installment. Tonight we have Amira Hanafi and Lathan Osman. And I'm Danielle Susie. I'm the curator and host of the 6 Points Reading Series. Thank you for joining us here in the beautiful historic Chicago Cultural Center. The Poetry Center was established in 1973, and we're excited to be celebrating our 40th year of promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. We do this primarily through two different programs. The first is the Hands-on Stanzas program, which puts working poets in Chicago public schools to teach poetry to young students. And the second is this reading series, which brings us to tonight's program. This reading series is a monthly sort of program that we've developed to showcase some of the most innovative and talented contemporary poets. And tonight we're really lucky to hear from these two fine, talented women. Books will be available for purchase after the reading, and I'll be in the back. We take cash and credit, or cash and card. Debit is fine, too, I imagine. And so first, our reader is going to be Lathan Osman, and she lives in Chicago and is the winner of the African Poetry Book Fund's 2014 Silliman First Book Prize for African Poets for her manuscript, The Kitchen Dweller's Testimony. She has received fellowships from the Fine Arts Work Center, Kaveh Kanem Foundation, and the Michener Center for Writers. A 2012 Pushcart Prize nominee, her work has appeared or is forthcoming in American Life and Poetry, Broadsided, Narrative Magazine, Prairie Schooner, and Vinyl Poetry. Please join me in welcoming Lathan Osman.
Good evening. I'm glad to be here with the Poetry Center. Thank you, Liz and Danielle. I don't really have anything to say. Get into it. I think it's real funny. I know that it was a coincidence, but that we're reading here on September 11th, which is interesting for a lot of reasons, but I know there's so many ways that so many lives were changed. And so what I was doing on September 11th, we were in school. I was a senior in high school, and they just kind of rolled the TV in, and that was it. And they didn't really, there's not really any context. I don't think that we could have had context, but so we were just kind of trapped in that day. And so many times as an educator, I think a lot about children and the children that were in school, especially the really little ones, and some of the ones that I teach that are adults now that would have been children when I was a young adult. And so that's something that really kind of sticks with me, the children that were in school and the extreme worry that I had, not only for obviously the people in those attacks and what would come from those attacks as we saw, but then also the children in New York schools who didn't know, right, about their parents and what was going on, and there wasn't anybody who was answering questions for us. And so I'm certainly thinking of the many tragedies around that. And so some of my reading will be around that. So I'll just start with some newer work. And so this is Sympathy for Satan. He's just a man, my mother would say. No clear prompt. Now that men have come, verb shifting, evading contexts, covering themselves in ash, then calling themselves dark, calling themselves devils, they begin flowery discourses. They sometimes enter a garden disguised as a fern. They petition for possibilities beyond ease. Satan asked questions he couldn't answer. He unmoored himself, maybe forever, because he dealt in knowledge, not rhetoric. Silence, confinement to the subjunctive, his punishment. If only, he says, if only leads to the devil. A miniature man vibrating in spit on my molars, destroying silicone sealants while I sleep, ashy palate sleep. He's a man, not capable of encouraging honey palates, not a sun that favors a window, not even a great mirror that bounces my own light onto my crown, just a man. In court, you submit to other humans. Wherefore the petitioner prays. I ask to dissolve the bonds now existing. A miniature woman had worried the marrow of my heart bone. How long will you live a half-life? A half-life. He's a man, only 8 months older than you. I believe in God's bounty. He calls himself the grateful. It lengthens the mind to jump over narcissism and find simple recognition, yourself in a great mirror of your own construction. I believe in God's bounty. Trust I'll ask Satan how it feels to court beings who chose distance from ease with no rhetorical intent, how he abides by such stupid curiosity. He must talk through his teeth. His spit must vibrate in his teeth. How it feels to deal entirely in regret, not even his own. It was the only humility God offered him, regret. The original arrogance, an attempt to reject the first subjunctive construction, if only. I ask myself what you ask yourself. Incredulous is the only word that works. What does it mean to pray for paradise now? We don't wonder at our distance from greenness. We could stand knee-deep in ferns and we can stand knee-deep in ferns and sob for another forest. Is it possible God isn't even angry? Bewildered is the only word that works. Certainly God could choose to go astray from himself, and we'd ask, what is your relationship to darkness, to light? Sympathy for Eve. It's another morning I wake holding my ankle with my right hand, its wrist with my left hand, a tender, one-sided crucifixion, pinning myself to sheets that seem wet. 5 a.m., always 5 a.m., and this time I think there are dozens of dead bees swaddled in the sheets, their thoraxes and wings wet. With what? Not even the air is moist. Not even my hairline, now that I've shaved my temples and nape, so I won't feel a man's hands in that hair. The way he turned from me is so far outside my narrative. I decided to consider Eve, the weight of what she could sense but never witness. Complete devastation. Bees and all their companions, everything in the archive of Earth, damp and beyond resurrection, her foresight my only understanding for the total dread I feel against my arid longing. That there is not even bees, nothing but my own belly against my thigh. I imagine Eve in her automatic credibility, her logic not yet accidental, no one to review evidence against her, no one to collect her papers, then read them generations later saying she lied. She was kind and not exacting at all. She wrote dozens of letters to Satan asking after his heart under the pressure of his choices. I consider Eve and the first time Adam turned from her after some argument that certainly involved naming, valuing, what it was for someone to spend a night truly lonely while not alone, his sleeping back to her and her saying, well, I have my own two arms and the faculty to catalog. Tonight is the first night one hand held tight the other. Or the first time Adam attempted to lead her down a path and she insisted it was a gorge, its bottom water and snakes, and she sat right where she was standing until the sun set. By that time, she'd seen enough refusals to know how to sit on sediment. Or the first time her very eyes were a seasonal path, restricted by vines and branches hard to strip or snap, and her pupil said, you may not enter until the ground has thawed. Adam paused and measured the snow at his feet. Or the first time she was in his arms, dizzy from too much sleep, and relaxed further into him, laid into him. We are not a biological imperative. We were joined for the impulse for story. I've been pursued by bees lately. This lady's like, are you aware there's a bee on your neck? There's a bee on your finger. There's a bee in front of your torso. I'm like, I'm aware I need to write a poem. That's what this is about. They're reminding me. So this is brand new, The Bee's Gospel. I enter a household wherein a woman uses stamps with blooms, zinnias, aster, primrose. She adorns envelopes carefully, remembers her mother's destroyed marigolds, and grieves for them again. At night, a man puts his palm on her temple, then her crown, unfolding meadows and every fruit and root. I sit on the headboard and wait for permission to enter. It is an expanding paradise. Everything knows its relationship to light, to darkness, pursues various means to the same ends, and his hand contains the aliving spice of a room full of palms. Where others say she is a warmth, a coat, he tells her she is the seasons. He pursues a single lyric. Where others name scents, he wears them several musks at once. In the morning, she splits a dense fruit. Within it are chambers, combs. She extracts seeds on the table, spends songs cleaning them. My guardian waits outside at the window, but I like how this man looks when he offers things, every object a gift, cup, washcloth, his scented chest and temples. I don't know which one is the queen, so I fly between them both, and the backs of their necks are the same. There are mirrors, mirrors facing each other across a well-lit room. I am in a frenzy. I visit a cup whose color I can't resist. Summer sky after 3 nights without rain. It contained a sweet fluid. I don't know the name of this nectar. It causes me to forget. I have to be near it, on his knuckles, on his shoulders. What does it want, she asks. It doesn't know, he says. What does it know of what humans made? Then he'll go and tell the others, she says. He'll recite. They try to kill me, not sincerely. I drop from ceiling to floor until they too are exhausted. She opens a window. I stay, parse their fragrances as she parsed those seeds. I want him to lay with her again, show me multitudinous gardens. My attendant can wait no longer. I salute her bare right breast and watch all her skin prickle and her scalp change color and fly out. So these next two poems are from a chapel called Ordinary Heaven, which appears in Seven New Generation African Poets, published by Slappering Hole Press. There are some people in here that know that collection. You should make some noises or something, because it's good work. It's good work. There's some really good folks in there. I'm very grateful to appear in there. You can find it on Amazon. You can go to Slappering Hole's site. And it's a beautiful collection with really beautiful original art for the covers. And so this is Ordinary Heaven. I arrange a doll in a chair and wait for her to speak. I want to say be to her, but am an ordinary creation. I watch for the folds under her eyes to twitch. I have many dreams, I say to her. In my dreams, I'm better than myself. I soften peppers in a well-greased pan and make announcements. I say, in the afterlife, we cannot allow a single particle of our light to diminish. I am not a woman prophet, but I know paradise. I have seen my soul sitting on grass that is not grass. There I learned God doesn't know shame, and after 6 days, he allowed our atmosphere to make certain souls wince. We crawl under its magnificence. Here I can attain ordinary heavens. Here I attend to my book of questions. What is love? Why does it say, allow me to mogul your soul? Where does it keep what it takes? What does the prostrating shadow request? Why do rocks enslave water? What is the slave's poem? Does the sea favor its roar or murmur? The doll cannot answer. The furrow in her bottom lip suggests that entry into ordinary heaven only requires recognition of it. For the soul's arrogance to weigh less than a mustard seed, I am sorry for her, I tell her. You witness, but don't testify. Water. I came to you carrying water. I came to you carrying silted water from a well, muddied, carried in a bucket with a split lip. My water tasted salty and like the earth and so like blood, and I brought as much as I could carry in a bucket that drooled tiny streams of water on my mud ashen legs. In all our days together, I have walked between well and house enough so the path is marked with the branching roads of my souls. I have come to you so often, the path has many other roads, if only you'll kneel in the dust and look for them. I am subject to you in the way the water is subject to the moon. You are subject to me in the way a wall is subject to its roof. And like the water, I expect you to come upon me of a sudden, like flesh out of a slit in cloth. And like the wall, you expect intimate collapses, capillaries of change inscribed day by day on our surfaces. I came to you with water from my deep well. I came to you with earth for your ready water. Water in every crevice for the valley that divides your tongue. I held your head in my lap and traveled the many roads leading out of that valley. And so I have three more poems. Yes, and so these are newer works around a lyric narrative of the Somali Civil War. I always kind of mean to explain this. So this is from a holy parable wherein a woman is sent to run from well to well to save a holy child. And that is the ritual that is mimicked when people do the pilgrimage in Mecca, Hajj. And so I was very interested in that controlled frenzy and that long-standing ritual. And my mother wanted to name me after one of those wells, and I often wonder how different my life would be, actually, if I were named that. So this is Introduction Through Parables, Marwa. I was named after a well, my sister too, after holy wells distant from each other. We are distant from each other. Our mother didn't intend it. War is the frantic wet nurse running between us. We are both thirsty. We are all thirsty. There is no divine child to make our waters holy. Our water heals no affliction. Who would supplicate at our bases? Seek our waters. In parables, girls are never divine, only their mothers. But like Abraham, I ask God to show himself. I ask in the plains. I ask in the desert. He answers me with light. He answers me with metal. Tea with an iron flavor. We sell it town to town. Migrants in our own wild bush, gunmetal sweat, weapon oil in the life and luck lines of my palm, we traverse the land. We move with shadow. We are guided by water. I ask God to show himself. A prophet quartered birds and waited for God. Yet another was given a hoopoe that spoke. Some have war birds. They too look. They too make reports. We live in a time machines have emissaries. But like Abraham, it's not possible to destroy me. It's not possible to destroy me. They try by fire and they try by sand. They try by metal and by verse. Still I traverse my land without a sister, with no family, not even a man who no longer accepts a hand on his chest when frantic. Myself, strange woman, strange girls traverse. In this parable, men and boys attain godhood. They send war to run hill to hill, well to well. War runs so fast she loses a shoe. There is no holy child. War ran with empty arms, an empty shawl. When men and their boys come to a frenzy, they can't submit to anything. No thing is a kindness. Nothing is a kindness. Don't touch me. Don't look at me with their whole persons. No one supplicates to frantic gods. Their command has no end. It can never become story. It can never become ritual. This is Parable for Refugees. 17 common flies. Clustered. Hallway. Days. They no longer fly through the screen when ushered. Week. To. From. Light. Real. Artificial. Did they forget the sun? Fly towards faces. Some dead on a sill. Some walk. Did they forget how to fly? Why don't they go? One paces on a step. Do they wait for a shoe? It averts them. Goes. Why die? Still. Is it madness? The ones who wait. And so, this is the last piece. Thank you so much for your attention. I feel really blessed to see such an array of people from different parts of my life and the artist community here, and I really am grateful to see you. And thank you again to the Poetry Center. So this is called Landscape Genocide. I know the mineral scent of seawater wherever I am. If the sun bakes the metal of earth, if my own damp scalp sweats, if I hold my handed palms to my face, God, there is no God but God into my metallic palms. When my period started, war started. Ever since the war started, I dye a henna disc on each palm. I refresh it when it browns, old blood. God, into my mineral palms when the whole street was white sheets, thin med digging, graves, night till dawn, till night till dawn. They paused for every prayer. An orb of light dragged me through a dim street, lifted me. I shouted, "This is my light," and held it against my belly. I was still. Beyond known stillness. A gravity of my own, and still I didn't light the street. The last thing my mother promised me was a photo of her, 5 months pregnant, backlit by the ocean. "Go at dawn," she'd say. The water was warmest at dawn. At dawn, girls went to the sea in whatever they were wearing. Their mothers couldn't keep them from the water, from walking fully dressed into it. There was nowhere to go but the sea. The orb, a giant marble in my diaphragm, would float with me there. Between this interior desert and the sea at the edge of my known world, orange Bacot tinted sand marked with the heels and balls of firm and dazed feet, charred acacias face down in the dust, succulents marking clusters of graves, graves of people and fruit-bearing trees, bones of tall livestock, the startling dome of a camel's ribs lit like a great hall by the relentless sun. There is nowhere to go but the sea. Between here and its mineral scent, bones of people, small and not small, bush lions and their young, always litters of bones at the line between known and wild worlds. Between here and there, the land in full prostration. The only song, metallic. Shells or whole bullets underfoot. Sometimes whole piles at the edge and center of towns put face down at night, at dawn, during afternoon prayer, at dusk, between here and there, the land and everything in it in full submission to the mineral scent of our water and blood and inability to cry anything, not even God, no God but God, we go at dawn. Thank you.
Thank you. That was beautiful. Thank you so much. Our second presenter, Our second presenter is Amira Hanafi. She lives and works in Cairo, Egypt, which I bet is not 50 degrees right now. She is the author of Forgery, Minced English, and various other printed matter. Her work has appeared in Fence, Diagram, American Letters and Commentary, and other fine publications, and is forthcoming in Pleiades. Her current project, A Dictionary of the Revolution, a popular documentation of the Egyptian Revolution, was recently featured in The Guardian. Amira received her MFA in writing in 2008 from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Please join me in welcoming Amira Hanafi.
Thank you. Hi. I have to move this a little closer. Okay. Hi. I'm really happy to be here. I used to live in Chicago, and it's really nice to be back here and to be able to read some of my new work. And it's really also very nice to see some familiar faces in the crowd and also some people I've never seen before. And that's really nice that I get to read to you guys. I'm going to read to you from just one long piece tonight, and it's called What I'm Wearing. It's published, I published it online, just on my website, and the form it takes is, basically, all the language in this piece is appropriated from newspapers and basically all news media that's online, newspapers, blogs. And so the online version of it, everything, all the sentences that are appropriated link back to their original source. So then I was thinking it's still very good for reading, but how can I communicate that through reading? So what I did is I assembled photographs that come from those original sources. That you'll see while I'm reading the piece. So I don't know if that makes sense, but probably it will once you see. And it's called What I'm Wearing. But what did I wear? You were wondering, right? The media is on it. My large Coke bottle glasses and lack of any notable makeup are the first things that stick out to you. I'm wearing a familiar style suit, but the color is strikingly different from what I usually wear. It is a bright old lady green. It looks like I just said, what difference does it make? I immediately kicked things up, well beyond provocative, as I appeared on stage with a multitude of dancing teddy bears in a bodysuit adorned with a cartoon character. I twerked, changed into a nude bikini, ran a fan's foam finger along my privates. People say, hey, do you think this is degrading? I'm like, of course it's degrading. What a pleasure it is to be degraded. Our forebears might be astonished at how safe I am today, given what throughout history would have been regarded as incitement. As I walked out to greet the troops, my coat blew open in a rather swashbuckling way to reveal the top of a pair of knee-high boots. My coat and boots speak of sex and power, such a volatile combination, and one that in political circles rarely leads to anything but scandal. It is as though sex and power can only coexist in a fantasy. When I combine them in the real world, stubborn stereotypes have my power devolving into a form that is purely sexual. Well, no one has ever accused me of being stylish. My uniform is something that I feel comfortable in and don't have to worry about, so instead I can worry about things like surviving, getting the story, making deadlines. So my professional uniform is a Beretta shooting jacket, a white shirt, beige pants or black jeans, and flat leather Todd's lace-up boots. I'm not trying to dress like a soldier or a photographer, but in this I feel appropriate, especially in the Muslim world. And being appropriate enables me to get my foot in the door. Unlike any president's wife in the history of presidents, I look as if I dress not to look appropriate, not to look political, not to look mature, but for my own damn self. And if that means wearing jewel-bright colors and pretty dresses and coats, then all the better. I wore a brown pantsuit accented by a turquoise scarf that helped soften my look, telling the small audience that I no longer believe in the old saying that it's important to dress for success. I find it interesting how the sometimes very unflattering styles I wear can have a reverse effect on my popularity in certain circumstances and cultures. It proves that looking glamorous or elegant in some cases can be an advantage, while looking more demure, matronly, or even dowdy can be an advantage in others. It's really impossible to come up with a formula for a successful political style. There is a sweet poetry in clothes that are womanly without being sexually provocative. But if the purpose of clothing from Adam and Eve onward has been linked to the idea of attracting the opposite sex, does it really make sense to take sex out of the equation? Perhaps the question should be asked the other way around. Is covering up the body the death of sensuality? There has always been an eroticism attached to what is behind the veil. As I scrolled through countless websites looking for hijabs, niqabs, khimars, abayas, jilbabs, and other religious-tinged garments, I began to notice that no one has anything positive to say about any of them. I figured that the only way I'd really know what life was like when consigned to wear the least revealing piece of clothing of all time was to dress up as one of them. The wind whipped my navy blue jilbab like a sheet on a clothesline as I wrangled a shopping cart. If I was aware that all eyes are on me, I gave no sign. Growing up in the 70s in Southern California, I had learned that freedom for me meant, among other things, fewer clothes, and that I could be anything and still look good in a bikini. I believe that the now ubiquitous bikini hurts me. Wearing a bikini shuts down his ability to see me as a person. In order to preserve my personhood, I should dress more modestly. The modern me is not prudish about my body. I just may not want to put my erogenous zones on display. I imagined myself in a string bikini in a few years. Then I imagined myself draped in Muslim attire. It was hard to say which image was more unsettling. I thought then of something a Sufi Muslim friend had told me, that Sufis believe our essence radiates beyond our physical bodies, that we have a sort of energetic second skin, which is extremely sensitive and permeable to everyone we encounter. You wear modest clothing, she said, to protect this charged space between you and the world. Here's what happened, as I described it in text messages to him. I was at the station at LAX, where the TSA checks IDs. The officer was glaring at me and mumbling. I said, "Excuse me?" And he said, "You're only 15. Cover yourself." Absolutely inappropriate, harassing, aggressive, creepy, unprofessional, and Taliban-y thing that he did. I lie on my back surrounded by four soldiers, two of whom are dragging me by the arms raised above my head. I'm unresisting. Maybe I've fainted. You can't tell because you can't see my face. I'm wearing blue jeans and trainers, but my top half is bare. You can see my torso, my tummy, my blue bra, my bare, delicate arms. Surrounding this top half, forming a kind of black halo around it, is the abaya, the robe that I wore, that has been ripped off and that tells you that I was wearing a hijab. I was arrested in 2008 on Spring Lake Salem Avenue Beach when I refused to cover my chest or wear a top. I was arrested a second time when I walked shirtless down Washington Avenue and where 25 to 30 gathered to see me. He called me a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty. I refused to pay the fines for an act that is legal for him but not legal for me. My naked body becomes an active instrument in confronting institutions of patriarchy. I donned a Catholic schoolgirl outfit and pretended to perform sexual acts on him. We watch the news for a while, and the infamous rape case flashes on the TV. Two high school football players raped me, while other students watched and texted details of the crime. I was naked the whole time, but I was like dead. I was a deady, and he needed sexual attention just like you, LOL. He should have fucked me. Why no head? I would have thrown up. Yeah, dude, it was bad, but I was naked, so it was all good. Maybe he is repressed. He doesn't see boobs enough. Otherwise, he would think, yeah, you know, this is wonderful. I show my breasts, and why not? Why extremists always focus on me remains a mystery to me. But they all seem to. It doesn't matter what country I'm in or what religion they claim. They want to control me. When a tool of oppression can be turned into an assertion of power, it is a beautiful thing. Nudity, when celebrated, harms no one. And when made shameful and barbaric, harms everyone. I say bearing my breasts is no different than him walking topless. I think North Americans are just way too uptight about nudity, and they equate it with sexuality, and it's not. Hussy, tramp, floozy, trollop, call me what he will. I wore lingerie and fishnet stockings, and I marched topless. He finally summoned the courage to speak to me, the best looking in the crowd. I was wearing a black bra and panties and holding aloft a hand-lettered poster that condemned any would-be critic for having a fucked-up perspective on the crime called rape. From his perspective, however, there was nothing about me to criticize and very much to admire. It took all the resourcefulness he could muster to walk up next to me, matching my long-legged stride, and say, "Those heels must be killing you." There's no need to reiterate in detail the reasons why I swear by uncomfortable 3-inch heels and why he is happy that I do. Heels change the way I walk, forcing my hips to sway. They alter my posture in myriad enticing ways, all of which are politically incorrect to discuss. The boldest fashion statement of the day came when I paired a conservative gray suit with stunning 4-inch bright pink stiletto spikes. But wait, you say, if I didn't want him to talk about my shoes, why did I wear them? A truly serious person would tiptoe barefoot. For some journalists, reporting that I wear high-heeled shoes of various colors and origins apparently passes for a weighty detail that gives some insight into my character. My pink Mizuno sneakers became something else, an implicit raised fist, an Insta badge of feminism. Negotiating a raise? Break out the Mizunos. Want to dream of a more equal world? Wear the Mizunos to bed. Is this feminism's next wave? One of the most striking moments comes when I sit in the driver's seat of a car, fixing my niqab so that only my eyes peer through. I don't use the niqab because he wants to hide my sexuality from other men, but because I want to keep my sexuality to myself and choose when to present it. You often see me, in many societies, being objectified because of how I look or being disrespected. The hijab helps force him, who might otherwise be unwilling, to take the focus off of my appearance. I dress in part to communicate to you who I am. It's why I don't cover myself when I am in the Muslim world, unless the law of the land requires it. I am who I am. I am not shy of being me in a society where I am nothing but a sex object harassed on a daily basis by him who knows nothing about sex or my importance. The photo is an expression of my being, and I see the human body as the best artistic representation of that. A coworker said, "You need to wrap a big old American flag around your head so people know what side you're on." From then on, he never let up. I don't know, I was fucked up. It was my fault, I was fucked up. Not even in the licentious days of Charles II in the 17th century was it acceptable for me to dress as provocatively as I have done in Western culture since the 1960s. For years, I have struggled to accept the fact that the way I look in a tank top comes off more sexual than if I were flat-chested. And once again, I was reassured by the media that someone with my cup size should always be covered up. Or what? I'll be seen as a slut? You understand that I want to drain the S-word of its misogynistic venom and correct the ideas that it conveys, that if I take a variety of sexual partners or I present myself in an alluring way, I am somehow morally bankrupt and asking to be hit on, assaulted, or raped. Definitely what's in the heart is most important. I have the right to be gross, to have hair, to be slow, to put on makeup, to not put on makeup, to wear fake eyelashes, to smell good or bad, and to be a human being. I am not his dog or his lawn or his living room. It's said that the clothes make the man, but he or I can also make the clothes. In my case, it's estimated that a single appearance in a designer's outfit is worth as much as $14 million. When the designer Yves Saint Laurent first encouraged me to wear trousers more than 30 years ago, his reasons were not simply because pants are practical or comfortable. He knew that the sight of me draped in the accoutrements of a man is sexually provocative. I was embracing something forbidden. Militias of strong, trained thugs grabbed me, tore my clothes off and beat me, groping me at the same time. The idea was to insinuate that when I took part in street protests, I wanted to be groped. I developed deterrent techniques, layers of light clothing, no buttons, drawstring pants, double knotted, and carried right on protesting. I just wanted to turn it over on its head and make people go, "Me and my body are beautiful. He is always going to want to follow me around." Thank you.
This is nice to be tall. Thank you so much, Amira, and thank you, Levin. Our next reading is October 15th, featuring the newly minted Ruth Lilly Fellow, Hannah Gamble, and our good friend Kenyatta Rogers, who's right here. If you want to just... Thanks, Kenyatta. And that's going to be here in this room on October 15th, same time. Why am I having trouble with words right now? Amira's book, Forgery, is going to be for sale in the back. Like I said, we take cash or card. It's really beautiful. They're hand-bound, silk-screened books, and they're amazing. Again, all of our programs run on donations, so you should feel free to visit poetrycenter.org. And if you feel so inclined, you should donate. And sign up for our newsletter to get more information and to get emails about this reading series and our other events. If you have questions about this series or the Poetry Center in general, please talk to me, or you can talk to our amazing executive director, Beth Sampson. Thank you guys so much.